This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Welcome to episode 27 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the podcast with the least defined narrative arc. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'm your host. Our topic for this episode is ludological arcs, which is a super fancy term that hopefully we're going to explain to everyone. And with me this time are two designers who don't even know how to spell ludological. First up is Mark McGee. Hey, Mark.
Hello, everybody.
Mark is already drunk. Okay. And also with us is Josh Mills. Hey, Josh.
Hey, everyone. And I legitimately probably can't spell ludological. That wasn't a joke.
I put it in there in the spirit of Josh.
Yeah, it's like 15 O's, I think.
Yeah, that's probably pretty close. Yeah. All right, let's go into our first segment here, which is what's in the oven. And since Josh is talking, we'll stick with Josh. What you been working on, Josh?
So I did something real dumb, and I traded a game I would design for another game with Tiffany of Nonsensical Gamers, and I just like, give me a theme-ish that you want. She's like, you know, creepy but fun, so we're going with Day of the Dead, and she wants to pull stuff out of a bag. So I'm making a Day of the Dead game where you're pulling basically little fun skulls out of a bag and decorating graves and the flowers, the whole offerended. Like, it's actually been really fun to just learn about the whole culture and, like, an entire kind of holiday that I wasn't really aware of. I knew it existed, and like, you always see the sugar skulls and people paint it up, but it's been really neat just to kind of dive into that. And the game's a disaster, so we're gonna need to pull that together pretty quick. But that's mainly what's in the oven, and doing some kind of expansion addition and add-on stuff for Milkman, just playing with, you know, butter and cheese and, you know, other dairy products to see what works.
You said that was a trade. She's giving you a game, and you're designing a game in exchange for that?
That is correct.
That's pretty interesting.
So anyone out there, if you have a game that you just want to get rid of, contact Josh, and he might take it and try to design something for you instead.
The worst part is I want it to be good. Like, I don't want it to be horrible. It's going to be playable.
That's the worst part about design, is making something that's
I'll
not
I'll just send all the components with no rules and be like, oh, sorry. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, 504 already was done, so you can't do that.
That's true.
All right, how about you, Mark? What have you been working on lately?
So I'm preparing Galaxy Alpha Team Number One Go for a contest, the Cardboard Edison contest. I'm going to put it in there, see what happens to it. Pretty excited about it. It's shaping up to be pretty well. Most of the time spent lately has been in editing my rules document and making sure that's pretty clear. As well as, you know, whatever edge cases, whenever players play it, they're like, what should I do here? Things like that, so the game can be understood without me being there, which is at least half of being able to enter a contest anyway.
Yeah, until, you know, you can record yourself like a little hologram that would come in the box. Yeah, you're going to need rules. Understandable rules.
Whenever the brain internet exists and I can just think thoughts and then you understand how to do it, that'll be pretty okay.
Are you not in the beta for that? I've said too much. Okay.
He's not allowed to confirm or deny if he's in the beta. It's an NDA on the internet brain.
First step to the internet brain is the existence of a brain, and I cannot confirm nor deny if that exists.
Yes. See, 4 minutes ago when I said you guys can't spell ludological. All right.
Messed up.
Yeah, I know. So, speaking of ludological, let's go into our main topic here, which is ludological arcs. So, the very first thing that we're going to do is try to define what is a ludological arc. Who wants to take a shot?
I define it, first of all, I use narrative arc and ludological arc as the same thing, because I think the narrative arc in terms of video games, or games in general, I might say video games from time to time because that's usually when I'm talking about this, but from interactive entertainment, because board games are still interactive because they're a set of systems. I see it as basically the experience the player has co-authored with the designer of said experience. So that experience is the story to me, which is basically the narrative. And the arc is what are the kind of the moments that make up that story. And from me, I always say the one of the big kind of pillars is the player is the protagonist. Anytime you're doing anything for me, the player is always the protagonist. If I'm playing a game and the player isn't the protagonist, then to me that is more of an authored medium and not necessarily something I'm as interested in an interactive form. But for I would just say the player experience and the story they create for themselves through that experience is the the narrative arc. And this is why we're going to call it the narrative arc, because that word is ridiculous, has like 17 vowels in it. All right, whatever.
So, all right, so before we get Mark's definition, you said you view players as the protagonist. What about a game where the players are in direct opposition, as in like a one versus many game? Are you saying that they're the protagonist of their own lens into the game?
Sure, just like every bad guy is the protagonist in his own thing. Like, the player is in control. Like, their story is them, right? It's how they're experiencing the world. It, you know, even if they're the bad guy, the good guy, I mean, it's all relative to how they're perceiving it. Obviously, you give them clues. But each person in the game, which is really neat when you have multiple people playing, has their narrative and their story. Think about it. I'll use other medium as examples, but from my point of view, it's you get a little dicey sometimes because those are authored mediums. They're not games. But if you were to write a book and the main say Harry Potter, you follow Harry Potter around. Now you write that same series and you're following Snape around, right? To me, like that's basically each person is one of those characters, and to them, you're the main deal. You're the important person.
So are you making a distinction when you say that between, like, if I control a character and then it's the story by the character, or is that still the same because I have 100% control over the character?
You're making the decisions. You're making, like, you're controlling the character and that kind of thing. Yeah, that's fine. Like, I mean, that's okay. There's a line, and who knows really what it is, and I could talk forever about it, but I'm not going to.
But you're saying that me as the player controls it instead of you as the designer.
Correct. Right. Like, setting up this the environment for which the story could be created. I'm not dictating to you what the story is.
You're defining the boundaries.
Yes.
So Mark, do you have a different definition of ludological arc or any thing to add?
I'm pretty sure mine's about the same, but I would use different words just because I don't use the words that Josh uses.
No one does.
But basically, like...
No, nobody does. Because you're going to use intelligent, smart, articulate words. I'm going to use dumb words.
But I was thinking, like, it's... So the ludological arc is how the play experience or the core loop or whatever... So basically how the experience given by the game decisions, how that changes over time as you're playing the game.
Okay, so there's a time scale... Like, if you were going to graph this out, right, like, your x-axis would be, like, time, and your y-axis would be something else, like, I don't know, tension or something.
Yeah, and that plot of experience, for just kind of a vague word that could encompass anything, experience over time, so how the experience changes over time is the arc that I'm thinking about.
Gotcha, okay.
For it to be a ludological arc, it is the experience that is given by... the game decisions or by people playing the game.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think that's where mine and Josh's are almost the same, in that it's based around the people playing it and experiencing it through playing it rather than being told what is happening.
Right. And I think that's the key and why I get a little uncomfortable when people refer to it as a narrative arc. Like, I think they're very similar. But to me, a narrative arc is being told, and you don't have any agency in that.
To me, that's only because we've spent the last 3,000 years not having games around, so that we need to expand our concept of narrative, right? The reason why I always say narrative is to push the inclusion of games within that kind of study, because otherwise, people that are uppity scholars look down upon games because they're like, oh, well, it's not a written, you know, it's not a book. And then movies have value now. Well, they didn't in the 30s, you know, like you guys came around. So that's one reason why I always try to say narrative, and instead of trying to gate it off, is just so the respect. And this is less of a problem now because my generation's getting older, right? For games, and especially video games, kind of gets pulled into that kind of value add. But that just hits a little close to home, right? Because that's what I do for a living.
Right. And I understand, like, the impulse there of trying to make sure that it's looked upon as like a legitimate thing, and that makes sense. But I guess I'm looking at it more of like a taxonomy viewpoint of like if we didn't have different names for different mammals, you know, like a dog versus a cat, we couldn't talk about what the actual differences are between those things, right?
So that I use authored versus created versus co-authored. I use those types of words for that distinction.
Right. And then, but I don't have a sense of whether the terms that you're using, if those are standardized or if those are something that there's just what you use as shorthand.
I use all kinds of crazy stuff that's just kind of made up, right? Whatever. But like, if you actually look at, there's a huge debate, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on this versus Ludi. I'm going to call it Ludi versus narrative, right?
Yeah.
And people have been going back and forth, especially in the academic world where they don't actually do anything like make games. That's a little burn there.
A little.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they talk a lot of game, and then it's like, go do it. I think there's an article called, The Narrative Theory of Games. It's just basically saying, like, would you two stop, competing against each other and whatever and kind of focus? And it's the reason why is because the terms aren't defined. Hmm. In academia, that matters a lot. And right. What I'm saying is not going to matter very much because I'm just, whatever you think the smart way was, just think that's what I meant.
All right, so listeners, for this podcast, when we're saying ludological arc and narrative arc, essentially we're saying that they are synonyms. Whether that is 100% true is a little bit up for debate, but for the purposes of this discussion, we're going to use them interchangeably. And if that's going to bother you, I'm very sorry, but that's how we're going to proceed. Right. And briefly, I also wanted to mention, in case listeners, if you are really familiar with the debate in academia, especially in the video game space, about ludology versus narratology, we're not going to touch that because that is not what we care about in this episode here.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was talking about too.
Right.
Like, I'm tired of people complaining about it. Like, just go make a thing. I'll tell you if I like it.
Right. So don't expect us to try to parse, very finely between those things. That's not the purpose of this this episode. So once again,
never parse.
Yeah, if you're expecting a very precise terminology, this is probably not the episode for you. Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I agree with how you guys define it. In my mind, I always try to attempt to visualize, like, if I was going to draw the graph of the arc of what that might look like. If you guys or if listeners are familiar with like the stereotypical three-act stories, yeah, three act, where usually like you start low and you build up in the middle and you have a peak and then you drop back down, sort of looks like a bell curve, which is, there's a lot of criticism around the three act, but it's also pretty popular and useful. But so that's how I like to try to visualize ludological arc. And it may be that kind of structure. It may be a different kind of structure or a curve. But that's kind of, I think, can be a helpful way to look at it.
Beginning, middle, and end, right?
And that,
a couple of exciting incidents, and you're good.
That arc that you're plotting, I think that has a lot of breadth to it. Because even though it is something over time, that something that it is could be any number of things. And in fact, if it's several different things all at the same time, then it starts to get really interesting. Like if you're plotting intensity of the experience, or like difficulty or complexity, or how impactful this decision at this moment of time is, if all those things are kind of going up in on that scale, and then they kind of come down for a lull after they peak, and then they go up to a higher peak, having several things going along that arc can get really interesting.
Okay, so let's we'll talk about that a little bit more. So what kind of ludological arcs do exist in games, and probably more tabletop for us, but if we want to use video game examples, that's okay.
We don't want to really use video games as an example, because they have a lot more, they get crazy. I would say, like, if a lot of times, and the reason why we speak, I think, in games a lot about mechanics is because they're related to kind of the narrative arc of the game, right? So, and some are hand in hand. Like, engine building game, you're telling me a couple of solid things about the arc of that, which is, I'm going to get a bunch of resources and I'm going to start upgrading my machine to go a certain direction, right? To like, I want to be like really into diamonds or really into corn, or I never want to feed people. Then I'm going to have a point where I'm going to go from building up this empire to executing with this empire, hopefully. And if a game doesn't do that, if you just build it up and it stops, people get real mad because they didn't get the climax, right? They didn't get to do the thing that's awesome two or three turns. And then you're going to need to end it really quick, mostly because the game will start to break or people will become fatigued from a narrative perspective. But what that does in an engine building game is it allows the player to make all those decisions matter. But the core arc, the game designer understands how it's going to exist, right? So I think that's a really good example. There's others, Mark.
Oh, so hang on, before we move on from that one, like an engine builder, so that's going to be where like you would start usually very limited, very restricted, and as the game goes on, you become more and more powerful, and you can do more and more things, and you can you start low, and the graph would go very high on whatever the scale is that you're measuring, and at that point, it could be the climax, it could be the resolution, dependent if you want to use the narrative terms. You start very restricted and you become very powerful. It's almost like a power fantasy in a way for the, depending on what the game is actually doing, but you start with nothing and then you become something.
Yeah. And your choices really start compounding in terms of how much they matter. Right. And a lot of people will upgrade certain things quickly at the beginning versus there's usually longer term strategies built into those types of systems that are, the fruit of your labor will be later. So you start to get these different points that the players experience, and then you know what the narrative is, the arc is, because when a game is finished, players will always tell you what it was. Oh, I did this and I was trying to do that, and then they might not tell you while they're doing it, but to me that's always a good sign that the arc exists and is working, is when people just share with one another, when it goes from like experience to an authored, then it's an authored narrative because you're just recounting your experience.
Yeah, I think a lot of strategy games follow a similar arc of like how the game starts more general and gets more specific to the point of almost being like a more personal level of decision making. So like in many strategy games at the beginning, you're kind of feeling out what options are available depending on early moves done by other players or whatever the random flop is that the cards display. And so you're kind of feeling that out. And as the game progresses, you stop being as general and you get more locked into one specific strategy until by the end of the game, you have your strategy and you're executing on that. And so every move can be like a make it or break it for that specific strategy. Whereas at the beginning, not everything is make it or break it for your strategy. It kind of allows you to figure out your strategy, but your decisions are more, I guess, personal because you've already chosen your approach. And each decision also has a bigger impact on your overall outcome in that sort of arc. And that kind of follows some of the other narrative arcs about, you know, growing more personal as the narrative goes on and also growing more impactful as the narrative goes on.
So one of the things that games do that is kind of directly like that is the ticket to ride to move, right? Hey, I'm going to tell you what it's almost like in a movie showing the end scene first, right? Like, this is what you're going to work towards. Like, here's the route thing that you want to complete. So this is giving you direction and a clear picture of what you want to achieve. Now, in a game, you could fail to do that, right? Like, in a movie or book, they're never going to fail to do that. And if they do, then nobody will ever read that book again because everybody hates it. But they do. Like, you never can get away with downers. But you have this, like, you need to build these routes. So it gives you a clear picture of what you want to achieve. Now, how you achieve it and who... Like in Ticket to Ride's a great narrative because then who blocks you, what changes you had to go through to actually end up finally getting Montreal to connect to wherever. All of those different decision moments, if you pull it off, add up to this really satisfying experience. You're not really building an engine in that one, but you are seeding kind of what you want the end result to be to the player at the very beginning, which, I mean, works beautifully in a lot of games.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely not viewed as like an engine builder, or not how the definition typically is. You could any game where you're building, you know, routes or networks, I think you could sort of look at it as an engine in that the bigger your network, the more possibilities you can cover. So like it's specifically for Ticket to Ride, like, okay, I'm going to draw more destination tickets, and because you know, I already have established all these routes. Maybe I've got a better, you know, opportunity to draw something that I can either I've already completed or I can I'm really close to completing. You know, so it's not the same exact as like an engine builder, but it's I think it could be viewed as a little bit of analogous in that sense. But yeah, it definitely has a different feel just because it you have that spatial network that is built out on the board.
And I think it actually has another piece of kind of a different arc that we've seen in a lot of games, which is that push your luck kind of system. Because though, especially ones that compound on one another, because those create some really interesting experiences for players and narrative arcs over the course of the game, because players are pretty usually making one decision, right? Do I keep going or do I stop? And how does that affect the other players when they're pushing? And you end up usually creating a pretty solid kind of story from that for the player, because even if you fail miserably or you go big and lose, that's a situation where it still can be satisfying just because you went for it, right?
Mm.
Hey, one of the more interesting arcs that I was thinking about in some games, so in Telestrations, it has a different type of arc. At first, I was lumping it into something that doesn't really have much of a ludological arc, but then the more I thought about it, I was like, you know, it kind of does, because you have your word that you start off with, and then depending on what the word is, that might start to build a little bit of anticipation, being like, you know what, somebody could really screw this one up. But then you pass it around, and then a few turns later, you get a picture, and you're like, I have no idea what this picture is supposed to be. And so you write down whatever your best guess is. But what that does is now you know that when later on, when everybody shows the reveal, you know that something interesting happened there. And so you're kind of excited about what it's going to be whenever you figure out the bigger story about it. And so as you see more and more of these pictures that get passed to you, and you can tell where some of them went off the rails, you kind of get excited to figure out and see how they got off the rails later on. And then once everybody's done and you go around the circle, like showing off how your word changed from, you know, bumblebee to like, you know, something ridiculous. I don't know, house fire or whatever. Then like, as you flip through those, it's like the payoff that you've been anticipating, and it gets to be really wacky. And so the anticipation really builds up until there's a big payoff at the end, which is an interesting, and it really works for Telestrations, but it's interesting game arc.
Yeah, and that's it's funny you bring that one up, because I was just thinking about, like, because we're talking about different types of arc. Well, you have like kind of, I guess, sub arcs, right? So like gameplays around where you kind of have this narrative that you're repeating, and then you have like the long term arc of the entire game. So yeah, like in Telestrations, it's each round is its own you know story system really for each person, but then over the course of even like Code Names, over the course of each one of those rounds, you're creating an entire kind of experience arc for everybody. That so we so link the story aspects of games to the mechanical experiences that we have with them when we talk about them, that it's always a little bit scary how often we do that, when we say one versus the other.
So how would you try to categorize the arcs in like Telestrations or Code Names? And so it's clearly not engine building. You know, how would you best try to describe those?
I don't know in terms of like mechanic words, but I think just anticipation and build up of anticipation, and then the payoff is how I would think of the arc.
So in terms of like the storytelling arcs, I guess that would be like the rising action.
Yeah, it would be like a very prolonged setup with a bunch of like foreshadowing, and then when it gets there, it's the reveal, and it's the payoff for all the foreshadowing that was done previously.
Hmm.
Yeah, and you in every turn, once it's your group's done and the next group goes, you have either tension added to your turn to your previous turn, or you have kind of a reward depending if they fail or pass or go bit, you know, get three things instead of one. So you have the interrelationship between the players also is adding the drama to what you're doing, right? And I think we see that a lot in worker placement too, because you're basically saying like, here a lot of times it's like, here's perfect information and these are the things you can do. Now how are we going to create drama and anxiety and tension? Well, that's just solely through other people doing what you wanted to do, or benefiting you, you know, doing something you wanted them to do. And I think being able to make decisions where you can either adapt if they're doing something you don't want to do, or, you know, kind of jump on their train, like say in Mombasa or anything with stocks, like I'm gonna play with you up on this track, or I'm gonna do that. Those are adding a long-term kind of story experience for those players, but also have very clear, you know, small loops for each one of those kind of actions. So that's why I say, like, with mechanics, we decide, and when we talk about them, a lot of times we're talking about the result of those mechanics are emotional things that we hardly ever use the emotional words for, like drama or tension or pressure or anxiety, or because we're in a game state and we're having play, so we don't really respect those emotions as much, right? Because we're just messing around. And when people take them too seriously, then you don't want them playing with you anymore. We always talk about the very hardcore mechanical version of that. Because I try when I design to say, like, this is what I want the emotional feeling to be, and then figure out what mechanics will allow me to produce that, which is a much more story-driven way of thinking, I think.
Yeah. So I think along the similar lines, I think, like, what sort of behaviors and emotions do I want the players to exhibit, rather than like telling them what I want them to feel or showing them what I want them to feel. I want them to do things that make them feel that way. I mean, I guess in a similar way, it's like, rather than abstracting a system into a representative system, like, this is the way that markets work, so we'll have a mechanism for all the aspects of a market, rather than like abstracting and representing that, I try to think of what does a market feel like. Oh, it feels like you want to gain stuff without losing stuff, or you want to grab good deals or whatever. So then I try to make the players do things and make decisions that create that feeling, rather than recreating the system in board game form. I try to find things that make players have the same feelings that they would have in that situation. And I think that becomes the feelings that they have becomes kind of that narrative of the story, rather than saying, oh, I did these things which are analogous to what I would do if I was in a marketplace, which is, feels like telling a story about somebody in a marketplace, as opposed to, I felt this way, so I did this thing, I struck a great bargain, and now your experience is more how you feel instead of what you did or what, you know, what you saw your character do or something.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with that mentality, and that's why I say, like, mm-hmm. the player is the protagonist, right? Because to me, what you just said is how you get someone to feel like they are the protagonist, right? You make them feel that way instead of what, I mean, you summed it up perfectly there. Like, you want to feel like a market. It doesn't need to be a market.
Yeah. Hey, let me tell you a ludological arc from recently.
Oh, please.
So I was playing Flamme Rouge last night.
This is exciting. Josh's favorite game.
Oh my god! I need to play it again with the other track. I did the basic track, and I don't know why everybody's so happy about it. But what?
It's shaping up to be one of my favorite games. But so I just played another game with my friend and my brother-in-law, and my brother-in-law, he was playing for the first time. He did some ridiculous thing, but ended up winning. So I was like, all right, let's run that back. And so we did, but it was just me versus him. So immediately there is some tension because I've played the game a handful of times, and he had won on his first go. So I was like, this is ridiculous. I'm going to show him how to actually play the game. And so just from the beginning, there's this, like, this tension that now the stakes are a little bit higher because I'm supposed to be good at it. You know, so the narrative is already kind of set. And so then what I desire, I paid attention to what cards he has left in his deck, you know, where his players are, how I can best take advantage of slipstreaming. And I was able to get behind him enough that he took on so much exhaustion, I was able to do an early breakaway. And then my roller was out front, and my sprinter was kind of in the pack with his two guys.
Oh, you could tell the difference? That's neat.
And I made a decision there. I was like, here, I had an idea, and I was not sure if the idea was going to work. I was like, let my roller just go on ahead as fast as he can, and my sprinter, rather than trying to get up there to help my roller stop taking exhaustion, my sprinter is just going to stay back and try to screw with these guys, make them, you know, split up their slipstreaming, make sure that I'm never in front so I never gain exhaustion, and also make sure I'm not in front so they don't take advantage of slipstreaming to get up. So I was able to, when I had this opportunity, I had a strategy that I was not sure if it would work. So I took the gamble and started doing that. Then what happened is it started working. And so then the excitement kind of got built up a little bit more. because my roller just kept on getting further ahead. And eventually, before the game was even over, he was like, I think my opponent, my brother-in-law, said, you know, I don't think I have a shot of winning this one anymore. And then it was kind of like the payoff, and then it was just coasting to the end. So the narrative of that game was like something that for me was memorable, and it had all the excitement of if I were watching a well-produced documentary about actual bicycle race teams. You know, they might put out that sort of detail about, you know, here's where he decided to make his breakaway. Here's where he decided to block for his teammate instead of try to, you know, help him with slipstreaming, things like that. And those are all things that would exist in a well-told story, and they all happen in a game that doesn't have a specific narrative. It has systems that allow for a narrative to happen.
And it's fascinating that if you were to graph your arc and your brother-in-law's arc, they would be. I bet they'd be very different. But you had the same shared experience, the same, you know, the same game.
Yeah.
That's the magic of games.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that you brought up is because you played it again, right? Mm. And we should probably note that in games, more than any other medium, we have the opportunity to repeat the arc, the arcs, which is not something that really happens because in other mediums, because you can't, like, you could reread the story, but it's not going to change, right? But you could go through the same game and have 15 different narratives come out of the end result, and that's super unique. Yet I don't think enough people take advantage of it. And I actually think board games do a better job of that than even like on the video game side, because in a video game side, a lot of times there's still it's still real tight in terms of how much freedom you really have. But in the game side, and it can be a lot more open because you also have other humans giving input because the game's reacting plus other humans are reacting. That helps a whole lot. Now, multiplayer video games, sure, they can do all that stuff too, but I think board games really have to focus on it because people talk so much about replayability, even though they only play games like a couple of times, but whatever.
Well, I would just like to point out, not as like a main point, but I think that written narrative especially has the power to be a different experience when you reread it.
Sure, especially once you know more information. But I mean,
yeah, I think the games definitely have that to a significantly greater extent. But I don't want to discount the power of the written word.
Right. Games are going to have a larger variance over what kinds of arcs you can experience. Yeah. And I think like a really well crafted novel or a really well crafted movie that has a lot of depth, I think you can certainly have a different experience on a rereading or a rewatching or even like an album MP3, kids. You can have a very different experience on a repeat, but I think games are much easier to have a more varied experience on a repeat.
I would say music would be the closest to games because of the emotional part that the player brings or the listener brings.
Right.
Music's much different than time of day could change how it feels.
Just right. Yeah. I was going to say that some of those other mediums, they even on repeat reads or listens or views, they can be different because they appeal to different parts of you at different times. Yeah. Depending on, you know, what happened to you that day or whatever. And that's something that I think games could actually do better about. I mean, I think games innately have the ability to be different every time you experience them. But I think that being different, depending on how you are different today versus the last time you played the game, I think that there's more room for games to take advantage of that than they currently are.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so young. It's so young. Yeah. There's more room in every single aspect.
Yeah. So we've been talking about arcs that generally speaking have some type of rising action or rising tension, or, you know, getting players are having even more agency into what they're doing. They're becoming more powerful.
They care about the choices they make.
Yeah. Do you guys know of an example that might work the opposite way, where not necessarily that there's less tension in the game, but maybe you're not going to be as strong, or so it's not rising tension, but you might have diminishing abilities or something like that. So it's almost, if you were going to graph it out, the slope would be going down instead of up.
I mean, any trick taking games like that, because you start off with a bunch of power and you slowly lose it.
Is that true for all players, though? Because it seems like some players might have Rising and some might have Descending.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, some players are going to outsmart the other ones and get what they need. But there's still, like, you're losing cards, right? Like, and this is, like, something that, like, even in the video game world, people are always like, oh, I should start off with completely maxed out and then slowly, like, end with a boss battle and I'm just fighting him with my fist. But the problem is that's super hard to... I haven't seen anybody do that really, really well yet. But from a tabletop perspective, I think when you start with a lot of options and then you slowly dwindle down and become less powerful, I think there's a common kind of criticism when you say runaway leader, where like people are like, that's bad in a tabletop setting. Like, oh, there's a runaway leader. Somebody just is demolishing us. I know I'm going to lose, right? We try to design away from that. But that's because that is that narrative for the three other or four other people playing, right? Because but we don't want to create that feeling for the majority of the people at the table because we want to sell four copies, not one.
But think about Dominion. This is going to be a rough example, but like, so the first, you start off with not much, and then you do start building up. But whenever you flip that switch to gaining points, so I'm talking about before you get a bunch of expansions, and the ways that you get points is by adding trash to your deck.
Just the base game then.
Yeah. And when you shift, you start getting a worse and worse deck, and you're less and less capable until until when you win, you're actually the least capable that you've been in a while. I mean, you're probably still more capable than you were at the very beginning.
Yeah, I think any game with that shift or like that pivot point, if you do it too early, then you're gonna be spent before the end of the game happens. If you do it too late, you won't have enough. I think that pivot point is usually you're going from building up to then spending all of it, right? It's hard because I don't think that form is as engaging to players because you're like, no one wants to get worse at stuff.
Yeah.
What about
React format? I think that, I mean, it's formulaic kind of in the sense that that's the standard, that's what people do, but I think that the reason that people do it and the reason it's a standard is because it's good and there's good things about it. So yeah, doing something different than that, like building down, is something less appealing about it.
I just thought of one that's like, it's dependent on comedy or people's participation, right? And almost a lot of the social, so think Cards Against Humanity or Telestrain, like those fizzle out over time because people cannot maintain that level of entertainment, right? Like it's hard to be, even if you have four or five people, to be entertained for a long time. That's why alcohol usually helps, because it lowers the bar for what is funny. And things don't get more funny, right? Like they just, your perception of what is funny goes lower. So like Cards Against Humanity would peter out over time if you kept playing it. And it often does, even over repeated plays. And that's one of the big problems with it, right? Because once you've kind of done it, it's spent, it's gone. But Matt, you said you had a thought there.
Yeah, it popped into my head. What about Yahtzee?
Yahtzee!
Yeah, so in the beginning of the game, you have all options are available to you. But as the game goes on, you're becoming more and more constrained in what you can do.
I definitely think you do get weaker in that one. But I think that what goes up is the impact of each decision. When I have three options...
Yeah.
I'm like, should I reroll to go for this, or should I just take this, you know, three of a kind, or should I go for this other big thing? You know, I think that the intensity goes up and the impact of your decisions, even though your ability goes down.
Yeah, you know, like a lot of times, even with like dexterity games, or even if you look at darts, when you're trying to get that last whatever, that happen, like the intensity rises so much. Because now you need to execute this one specific moment. So it kind of all hinges on that. And that is, I mean, that's super drama. You have direct conflict between two things and you can only execute one way.
That's the showdown at the end of all the Westerns. The whole thing building up to this. This can go one of two ways.
Can you imagine, though, if you played Agricola and it comes down to just like, who draws faster? Boom, you win.
Who farms better?
Oh. Yeah. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay. Yeah. I see what you're saying, Mark, about Yahtzee and that the decisions, I guess it's going to depend on exactly like which boxes you have left to fill out. It could be possible, just depending on how the game has gone, that if you had two things that are very disparate, that there might not be a lot of tension, because like, if I need sixes yet, and I need a small straight, you know, and I rolled sixes, or, you know, I rolled like two sixes. Okay, I'm going for sixes, right? There's no choice. And
I'm in phase 10's like that too, right?
We don't speak of phase 10 on this podcast.
I know you hate it and whatever. Yeah. That's because it's that system. It's like you get worse.
Yeah, okay. I'm curious if there is any game out there that does have that kind of just more constrained. You know, you get weaker, you know, like Josh was saying, like, you know, just fighting the boss with your fists because you lost all your equipment or whatever. I wonder if there's something out there that we're not thinking of. And
how about Scrabble? It's so much harder to put words on that board, and you're stuck with all your Z's and your Q's at the end, and you're like, I can't do anything. And you just pass for the last three turns, and then you go home, and you're so sad.
I am not a fan of Scrabble, so I couldn't even talk about it intelligently.
I don't play word games.
Yeah.
I can't. I lose. I don't even know how to spell ludicological.
Yeah, because you'll never have 15 O's on your little record there.
Never 15 O's.
Yeah.
I think one thing we might be overlooking is the perception versus the reality, right? Like, you might perceive like you have a ton of choices and fields of R or whatever, but reality, based on your previous choices and strategy, you really only got two things you can do. One's a really good one, and another one gives you a half a point, so you'll just do that one instead. So, like, yeah, it seems like you have a bunch of choices and decisions, but in reality, if you were playing optimally, you don't. And that's a nice trick, because it makes people feel good, like they aren't super limited, but in reality, if they're trying to win, they are.
So how does that affect the arc of that game?
I mean, you're still, it's similar to like the same thing we just said, in terms of like you're funneling down to this moment where you're either going to make it or break it or be able to pull off these last two things. That's why it always feels good in that last round when it's like, hey, after this player, everybody gets an additional turn. If that's the turn where you execute the three things that you needed to do, awesome. If on that turn someone takes the space you needed and you no longer can get those 6 points, that's pretty rough, right? So, but you don't really have a, I mean, sure, you could do seven other things, but why would you want more wood at this point? You don't need it.
Okay. So related to this discussion about the arcs here, is, does every game have a ludological arc?
For me, absolutely, because the person playing is playing it, right? Now, does it have a good one? that's a different story.
Right. All right. Let's not say good or bad yet. So Josh, you're saying that yes, every game has one.
By the way I define it, given it's the player's experience, then it would have one.
Okay. How about you, Mark? You agree? Disagree?
I'm kind of on the same thing. I think by definition, if it's a game that people play, it's going to have an arc. I believe. I mean, I can't think of any way for it not to.
It could be flat, but yeah.
If it's just a really... If the game doesn't have any progression, then maybe there's no arc to it. Because it's flat. Like, but I think that even the boringest games, if they have a scoring system or even just something like that, all of a sudden there is an arc, because you're either closer to the end, which means maybe take fewer risks and be more conservative, or you're further from the end, which means if you're behind, take more risks. So even that, in a game of pure chance, I think it would still have an arc.
Hmm. Have you guys ever played a game that you felt did not have, like, enough of an arc? And if so, like, you know,
sure, almost every prototype I make the first time.
Published games. Let's go with published games.
Plum Rouge? No.
Oh boy.
Burn. I think I mean, that usually when it doesn't, it those games are the ones I forget and that I don't come back to, and that basically are just like, yeah, that was all right. Things happened, but I didn't have any emotional connection to it. Those to me are the games that are lacking for me personally, because the experience was lame.
I think. Are you looking for one right now?
Well, yeah, I was just looking behind myself to be like, have I kept games I don't like? Probably.
So I was thinking about, and some people like this game a lot more than I do, but Guilds of Cadwalon, for me, when I think about my experiences playing it, it's got different rounds, and every round is more or less the same as the round before it, and there's not really a ton of holdover from round to round, and the decisions that you make at the end are basically just as impactful as the decisions you made at the beginning, and so nothing really escalates, and it doesn't get more complex or more intense, and my decisions are not as much like make it or break it. It just kind of stays flat most of the whole game.
I've played Guilds of Cadwalon once. I did enjoy my one play. Perhaps further plays would illuminate the flatness of the game. But it seemed like they were trying to build in the tension in subsequent rounds by the set collection mechanism in the game.
And yeah, you get to keep special powers that you didn't use and their set collection, which, yeah, generally they tend to make it to the later rounds. You make different decisions because I want purple now, so let me try to get the purple card. So yeah, mm-hmm. I feel like the right pieces were there, but it didn't seem to really matter. And so nothing get more intense or more interesting or more impactful.
Hmm. Yeah, I actually have two examples. One is Felinia, which is from Michael Schott. It's a weird game that you're like cat people that are trying to take boats across the water to explore an unexplored island to get tokens that are going to give you like points and
God, I wish people would stop making that theme.
I know. The cat people is super overdone. Yeah.
So overdone. Yeah.
But this was one that, like, if you read the rules, it seemed like it would be really interesting. But then when you play, sort of what you're describing, Mark, with Guilds of Cadwalon, each round just feels the same. And it just doesn't feel like there's any kind of progression that goes on. Like, you don't get more powerful. You don't really get more abilities. You don't unlock anything. You don't get further constrained. It's just, okay, we do this again, and there's some more tokens, and that's it. And so that was one that was actually, like, I think the first game that I played where I really sort of immediately identified that, wow, this is just really flat, and this doesn't have an arc, and holy crap, games need to have arcs. That was like a light bulb moment for me. I don't think a lot of people have probably played it anymore because it's sort of, it was published, I don't know, 6 years ago maybe, and it's...
Oh, so it's an ancient old game.
Well, if a game these days is over like 2 years old and no one's talking about it, it's gone. No one's worrying about it anymore. The other example is actually one of mine, which is Balloon your Delivery balloon. Service.
Yeah. Your balloon game?
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's
boring as hell. No, I'm just kidding.
It's like really interesting for half the game, but the game goes on too long and there's not enough of an arc for it. And that was it was actually playing Felinia, which I played after I had designed Balloon Delivery Service. That's what kind of unlocked that for me, is made me realize that that's the problem with Balloon Delivery Service. It's just too flat. Again, the decisions that you're making in the beginning of the game are largely the same that you're making at the end of the game. The only thing that you are getting during the game is money from completing deliveries, but nothing really changes.
Yeah, and I would say it's too flat or too long. One of the two.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and so that kind of leads me into an ancillary question is, When you're kind of building an arc into a game, how much is the duration of the game? How much does that matter in your arc? Is duration like the key component? If you make it short enough, do you just not need to worry about having too steep or shallow of an arc because it's just too short? Who cares? Or do you still need to worry? Regardless of duration.
Yeah, I think you still need to worry. I think when you say duration, I'm thinking pacing, because you still need those moments where you get to make those decisions that compound on one another. Yeah, if it's shorter, you can get away with a lot fewer of those moments. But at the same time, I mean, like, trick-taking games blow my mind because people play them for 4 hours, and it's like the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. But because the results compound on top of each other, they're getting a different kind of experience. But I think you could get away with a less of an arc for a shorter piece. I mean, we see that in other mediums like TV and all those, 22-minute sitcoms are not crazy on narrative arcs. A lot of times they're hitting on those moments instead, right? Like, here's a joke, here's this. Like, oh, Leslie needs to get her hair fixed because it's purple. And by the episode, end of the episode, she did. But a lot of fun stuff happened in the middle that was hilarious, but wasn't really that important to that main arc. I feel like that's how a lot of fillers are. Like, I'm going to do some really funny, crazy, weird stuff will happen, and it will be goofy and fun, and it'll be over, and it won't overstay its welcome.
Yeah, so I was thinking about No Thanks, because I think No Thanks has an arc, but it's such a short game. Like, as long, in a game as short as something like No Thanks, as long as a few interesting things happen while you're playing, maybe it doesn't really need much of an arc at all. Like, oh, this, like, we played for 10 minutes, and there were three times where it was like, oh, this is interesting. I forced him to get the 34, and so he lost Rafflecopter. And then that's like, that's enough to be exciting that even without like a well-crafted arc, it's still good. And maybe that is a well-crafted arc because that thing happens sometimes.
Yeah, you got in, you got out, right? You got the experience you knew.
Are you not a fan of No Thanks, Mark?
No, I like No Thanks a lot. I just think that it seems to be different than other games in that pacing can be whatever. If high cards come out at the front that nobody wants, you know, the pacing is fundamentally completely different than if low cards come out of the front. But it's short enough that it doesn't really matter. It seems like a very loosey-goosey style game that's over in 10 minutes. But it's good maybe because of that. I don't know how I could define the arc that No Thanks has.
I don't know. To me, like, it's an ebb and flow type of arc. Like, I'm acquiring a lot of chips. I now have a lot of power. Like, I'm you know, so for me, it's rising.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you know, when I'm paying chips and my chip, you know, pool is diminishing, I'm getting a lot more attention, and I'm losing, you know, control almost of the market in a sense. You'll have, like, a lot of peaks and valleys, I think, in that arc.
Yeah, I could definitely see the ebb and flow, and maybe that's what makes it work, because there's several short ebbs and flows, and then 34 comes out, and then everybody freaks out.
That's perfect. That's exactly what I need to unite my two runs, and yeah, you guys can't let me have it. And who's gonna fall on that grenade? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. All right. So this leads into the last question here: is how do you build an arc into a game? What's your recommendations, or what are your methods?
Okay, well, I think what you're really doing when you're designing a game is you're building an experience, which is in my case the arc, right? So you're constructing the scaffolding of what the narrative experience can be, right? And you're doing that through mechanics, rules, and then the opportunities presented to the players, and then also the most important one probably is the choices the players take. All those things make up kind of the environment that you're building for the narrative to kind of come through with people play. Obviously, there's certain mechanics that are going to lend themselves to certain dramatic elements, like bidding and outbidding. You know, you're going to have a winner and loser, and you can deal with the money that way. Like we mentioned, worker placement, where you're denying people things. You have positive benefits. All those tiny little elements to create different emotions. But for me, what I try to do is make sure that the playground that is the game allows for people to kind of discover something they can do that isn't denied by the game, that feels unique and gives them kind of a moment. So it's like the rules aren't restrictive in the way they don't restrict these cool moments that can happen. A lot of people call this like combos or combos is I can't think of another word for it, but basically if someone asks a question, it's like, oh, can I take this, then do this, and then use this ability, right? I tend to want to add the rule set, the answer to come out of that rule set to be yes, because those moments where people put things together and they feel unique to their experience, those are the kind of the pillars and the points that are building up this arc over the entire game for them to, when they talk to somebody else, those will be the things that they recount first, or the reason why they start the story to begin with, right? I did this awesome thing. And you could see that in my designs. You could see that in in Rocky Road and in Milkman, where you're basically like, here's a dice. A lot of times I will be, you resolve your actions in any order you want to. right? Because I want you to come up with unique ways to do that. It also creates a lot of problems when you're designing, because you're like, oh, great, now they could do this, this, and that. And other games do it, too, like Takenoko. They do a neat thing where, like, the weather dice gives you little abilities that then you can use on that turn specifically to be like, now I can take this action twice to be able to do this thing. So they restrict it a little bit, but it still feels really good because then they have that kind of, like, luck element and opportunistic approach. The longer-term strategy stuff that you add in there, I think, is just about making that those last couple turns really satisfying, and all that work and choice and paying off the choices you made throughout the entire game in those moments. So that's how I approach it. Now, what those individual elements are is going to be really dependent on me for theme, because theme and environment to me go hand in hand, and that's another way to have people kind of put emotion into the game, because that's what you're really trying to do, is get them to put their emotion and thoughts and into the game. They'll tell you they're not doing that ever, because they don't want to admit that they're they're having an emotional experience while playing a game, because that seems ridiculous. But they are. Just because it's a positive, fun one, or their frustrations inside of the playful arena, you still want to give them that. So that's how I do it. I don't know how other people do it.
Yeah, I think it's a lot about having systems that provide growth, not just like growth to the game, but growth to what the human player who's playing the game is capable of doing, which, yeah, like in the form of combos, or, you know, somehow over the course of the game, I started from being able to do this one thing, so now I have three different cool things that I can do. And so as the game developed, my capabilities as a human playing this game are now greater than my capabilities were at the beginning. And if given the same decision now in this new context, I might do something different than if I were given the same decision in the context of the beginning of the game. So I guess systems that allow for growth, and systems that allow for growth not only in depth and also in breadth of options. So, like, I guess in depth I mean by the decisions can have more impact, I guess, near the climax of the arc than they had at the beginning of the arc.
So the magnitude of the decisions will change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your choices matter, right? And the ramifications matter.
Right. So as an example, I've actually thought a lot about this when designing Galaxy Alpha Team Number One Go, because...
Nice plug.
At some level, a lot of the arc of that game is very directly taken from narrative arcs of like movies and whatever, because it pretty directly has three acts of increasing intensity, because there's literally fight bad guy battle one, after that fight bad guy battle two, and after that fight bad guy battle three, and each bad guy battle is more difficult, but at the same time, each bad guy battle, because you've taken spoils from the previous battle and repaired your ship, you are also now stronger than you were. So the stakes are a little bit higher because the bad guy is more difficult, but your ability to do cool stuff is now also bigger because you have all these special powers unlocked. And that progresses until at the third round, your ship is basically pretty close to maxed out, but also the bad guy is pretty close to maxed out. And the third battle is designed to be the most difficult, but it's also like the win big or go home sort of battle. And that's pretty directly taken from movies and other things that use the three-act thing, which at first I was really hesitant to do that because I don't like doing things that other people do. But I've come most of the way full circle around that, in that I think that it works, and I think that if nobody else had ever done that before, I still think that it would be the best thing for my game. So now I don't feel like I'm just like using the formula of the standard three-act narrative arc that increases the intensity heights of the plot, followed by small lulls until the next act goes to a higher intensity level, because I feel like I'm doing that not just because everybody else is doing it, but also because it works.
You analyze what it is and decided that, you know, why it works, and have a pride at applied it appropriately.
Yeah. For a while, I was trying to see if I could just get away with having three different battles and just have one battle that grows in a different way, but it was not as good as like the more directly formulaic seeming three distinct battles.
I totally understand when you say you don't want to do things like other people do, because I have that same instinct, and I think that And here's the resolution of the climax to this episode, is like, that's a lot of growth as a designer, or, you know, depending on whatever it is that you're working on, whether it's game design or anything else in life, is to realize that it's not necessarily bad to do what other people have done. There's probably a reason why people have done that kind of stuff. And
that's when you should definitely steal from them.
You know, that's the crass way to put it. Yes.
I think that it is stealing, but once you figure out how it works, it's not stealing anymore. It's doing it yourself.
And ooh, just deep thoughts. The same.
Yeah, like exactly. It. Yeah. And it's almost like a switch that has to get flipped in your head. Before you realize that it's not just doing something that feels wrong. It's actually, no, this is the way it should be, and this is why.
The Greeks and the Egyptians should have been telling stories for like a really long time, and they figured out a lot of stuff. Probably should just bank on that.
On that note, is there anything else we want to mention about ludological arcs?
I will say that most of the games I'm talking about here is because of player experience. I'm not talking about games that have like an authored story that people are trying to convey through some means of gameplay, right? Those games also don't interest me as much because of the way I see narrative within games too. That's not to say, I mean, I've played like Heavy Rain or even Tomb Raider, and I enjoy those type things too in the video game side, but I'm much more inclined to enjoy something that gives agency to my choices.
Yeah, so I was playing, this is, I guess, a year or two back, Descent. And so Descent actually has a narrated arc of the story. But in addition to that, during the missions, you know, you get upgrades for your dudes and you encounter bad guys. And so I was playing a campaign with some friends. And as the campaign progressed, we got closer and closer to whoever was the actual big bad guy in charge of stuff. But turned out that we didn't care as much about the actual real life big bad guy, because in one of the early missions there is a goblin, I think it was Splig the goblin, something like that. He
loves Splig.
He killed one of the farmers we were trying to rescue, and I think we actually lost that mission against Splig the zombie or the goblin, but because he was the first character in there to defeat us, for the rest of the campaign, we didn't care about like the actual narrative about, oh, here's the real dungeon lord who's really controlling everything. We're like, screw that guy. Let's find Splig so we can beat his tail, because he beat us that first time.
Literally, you telling this story is the definition of what you're trying to create, right? Like, yeah. You're like, we did this, and Splig is the worst, and I hate him, and we're done. Like, to me, yeah. Like, if you're using a story in that way, it's just another element. Like, it's part of the mechanics, the rules, the choices, the opportunities, the story. It's all part of that environment that you're creating to create the real narrative for the player.
Yeah.
But so that's our, like, our perfect narrative, example.
Our narrative was different from the authored narrative, and we got to the point where we started ignoring the authored narrative because we couldn't kill Splig in the authored narrative.
I get it.
Did you guys finish the campaign?
Yeah, well, our DM eventually changed the story so we could fight against Splig, because every time we played, we were like, dude, I bet Splig is like the reason that all these bad things are happening. And so he eventually changed it so that it was. I mean, and that's why, you know, role-playing games and anything with a dungeon master who's given the freedom to change stuff, that's why those work so well, because if they're good at what they do, they can, the experience that the players are having and the narrated experience can be the exact same thing, and with that level of cohesion, then it gets like really interesting and memorable.
All right, very good. So let's move into our news segment here. We have two pieces of news. First one is that group member Daniel Solis has released two new games in his I Can't Even line. We really need someone with a Valley Girl accent to say these names.
I was about to try.
It's okay.
I got it. I can't even with these monsters.
That's oh my God. Valley. I can't even. Okay. Sherry has been all up in my business all day. I can't even with these monsters right now. All
right, so the two new titles are I Can't Even With These Marvelous Supers, and I Can't Even With These Spectacular Supers. They're both available through Drive-Thru Cards. The links are in the show notes for the episode. I have played both of these, and they're very much in line with the first one, I Can't Even With These Monsters, which is a really neat little twist on you know, kind of scoring for this kind of game. And if you don't know the twist, it's that you can't have an even number score.
I really like how the length of his names have gotten longer as his series has gone on.
I can't even with Daniel Solis right now, him liking Plum Rouge. I just can't.
And the other piece of news is also about Daniel Solis. We mentioned on the podcast a while back that his game Trickster was picked up by Action Phase Games. And since that time, Action Phase Games has been purchased by Indie Boards and Cards. So that's they're all part of the same company now. So Indie Boards and Cards is going to have a Kickstarter project for Trickster in late January. I believe the date is January 24th, but these things can change. But sometime around January 24th, I imagine, that project will be alive and available for backing. And I've seen the art for Trickster, the actual Indie Boards and Cards version, and it's spectacular. So yeah, I believe it's Beth Sobel that is doing the art for that. I may have that incorrect, but I think it's Beth. But the artwork is absolutely spectacular. It's going to be, it's really going to wow people when they see it.
I also would just like to mention, I got my pre-production copy of Rocky Road a la mode from Green Couch Games, and this thing looks ridiculously awesome. Like, it is super colorful. They can see it. Oh, it's like a real box, real game. Super excited. You guys are going to love it.
Do you know when... when that's coming?
Like, obviously, you get the pre-production copies, it okays everything, and then soon they'll get on a ship to come on over here. So I don't know what that timeline is. Probably March, I would guess. But, I mean, I'm not the publisher. But I got my copy, so I don't really care about you guys. No. I'm just kidding.
Well, on that note, Josh, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
If you want to yell at me about not having your amazingly sweet Rocky Road a la mode box, you can hit me up on Twitter at Joshua J. Mills or email me, joshuajmills@gmail.com.
All right. And Mark, how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at mmark40. That's probably the best way to reach me. I'll respond.
Maybe.
Yeah. And all three of us will also be at Unpub. That could just come to us.
That is true, yeah. We will be at Unpub 7 in March, which is frighteningly close. It's actually 2 months away as we're recording this.
That's so good.
Yeah. So that's going to wrap up this episode. If you'd like to discuss this episode, please use our guild on BoardGameGeek. If you go to podcast.gdofnc.com, that's going to redirect you to our guild over on BGG. All feedback is welcome, good, bad, indifferent. We welcome it all. And we also have a group Twitter account that you can follow, which is at GD of NC, which, of course, stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember to measure the arc of your designs, and we will see you next time.